You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a list from the acting director of national intelligence shows former Vice President Joe Biden among top Obama-era officials who may have tried to unmask the identity of President Trump's former national security advisor. We'll find out what that means and other developments in the Michael Flynn case. First, new numbers come out every day in the coronavirus pandemic, the numbers of cases, the death toll, the percentage of positive tests, and more. The overall death toll in the United States is approaching 85,000 today, which most public health experts say is probably an undercount. But our next guest is worried that the daily numbers are becoming background noise, and that in the effort to reopen the economy, we might be too willing to accept the daily death toll as a fact of life. Charlie Worzel is an at-large writer based in Montana for the New York Times. Charlie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, do you see this happening, the idea that Americans are, in a way, growing numb to this daily death count caused by COVID-19?
Yeah, I think so. And I don't necessarily think, this is obviously a terrible notion and a very callous and cruel one. But to some degree, it's also understandable. I mean, we're not used to death at this kind of scale, and it's difficult when it happens across a large country like ours to contextualize it. It's hard to, if your town isn't experiencing a massive outbreak, if your hospitals aren't overrun, it's hard to understand and comprehend what 2,000 deaths a day looks like, or 1,800 or 1,500 or even 900. We've tried, I think, to try to direct some comparisons: the number of people who died throughout the conflict in Vietnam, the number of people who perished on 9/11, but none of those things are really adequate, because it's happening over such a large, area and over this period of time. So I think that there's just some way that we almost, just as humans who have to adapt, we have to, we have to take care of our kids, we have to sort of move on, every day and live. And sometimes, you have to sort of numb yourself to that. So I think that there's a little bit of that happening, because it's hard to process the scale of the devastation we're seeing.
But you're also worried in your piece that apart from becoming numb, we might also accept this death toll, I think, as a consequence of reopening and doing business. And you worry that may lead us to bad choices. How do you see that potentially working?
Yeah, I feel to some degree, when you look at some of what's happening out there, when you look at some of the resistance to the stay-at-home orders and resistance to shutting down the economy, we're starting to see that these discussions are framed in terms of things like liberty and, my freedom to go out and make a living, and my freedom to go in public spaces or not to wear a mask, whatever you want to say, whatever you want to call it. And that we need to get back to some sense of normalcy, because it's economically crippling, and sort of, virus be damned. And I think that it's basically suggesting that there's some kind of acceptable price that we have to pay for this. In order to open our economy, we're actually going to have to, just with this virus still around, we're going to have to accept a certain number of deaths. And while no one will come out and say it quite harshly, it does seem like there is a move by some to want to accept this.
You make an analogy with firearm deaths, becoming background noise. We have this regular toll, largely because of suicide and gun death. Can you compare and contrast those for us?
Yeah, absolutely. As a country, we are relatively numbed to that gun violence. There are bigger mass shootings that we are very aware of that make news and sort of engage the same debates over and over again. But the needle doesn't really move. And even when those terrible events happen, they don't shut down public life and public discourse in any way. They're just sort of, they've become part of the fabric of the American existence. 36,000 Americans are killed by guns. That's roughly, 100 per day, and most from suicide. And it has become in our national conversation almost an acceptable toll to some degree. It's politically not viable to pass effective gun control or gun safety legislation, including more stringent background checks and gun show loopholes, red flag laws, licensing systems, things like that. And so we have sort of resigned ourselves to the fact that, this is part of the American experience. And I think that debate and that that stymieing of gun safety laws is led by a small fringe group of gun rights advocates who are, essentially they're not representative of the larger gun owning population, which is a group of people who are very responsible and who are who really take gun ownership and the Second Amendment incredibly seriously. It's part of their culture, and they do it in a very responsible way. And it's a really great show of what makes our freedoms great. But that is sort of perverted by a smaller group of people who frame it as any sort of measures towards safety, any measures towards a collective thinking towards driving down, our national death toll is tyranny. And I think we're seeing a lot of that with the liberation protests. Those are small protests. Public opinion, as it is with gun safety, is actually well in favor of laws that will, protect people and also protect our rights. And that's the same with, I think, with this virus. But the fringe is really the group that is dictating the conversation, and that makes it very, very difficult to have a productive one.
Talking to Charlie Warzel, Montana-based writer for the New York Times, about a piece he wrote saying he's worried that we're becoming desensitized to the daily death toll of COVID-19. Reading your piece, Charlie, I thought of another cause of death here in the United States, drunk driving. And the Mothers Against Drunk Driving and other advocates did a good job of, I think, personalizing, like showing the individuals who are affected by drunk driving wrecks, and used that to bring attention to that issue. When you look at the media and our focus on numbers, do you think we should have more focus on the individual tragedies that go along with that?
I think that's a really great comparison, because they have done a great job. And I will say, I talked to a number of gun safety advocates, and they're also, they're very empathetic. They want to have a dialogue that preserves the rights of people while also acknowledging the pain there. And I think the same thing has been done with the drunk driving advocacy, where you have a very, you don't have people who are trying to, bring back a prohibition or something like that, but it's about, finding common ground. And part of doing that is to ground the story in human experiences. And I think that is partially, that is some of the difficulty, I think, with COVID-19 and what we are seeing. It is not attacking communities uniformly. Even in some states, there are places that are heavily hit and others that are sort of that are spared, and it seems like there's no real rhyme or reason. And so if you're in a community that hasn't really experienced that, it's very easy, say if you live in New York City, to understand the stakes of this virus for young and healthy people and older and more vulnerable people alike. But if you live in an area that hasn't really seen this, it might not feel quite real to you. So I do think grounding the conversation around this virus in that same way, around real stories, around real showing and explaining what is at stake here, it will be a crucial way if we want to have some common ground in this debate.
We're talking to New York Times at-large opinion writer Charlie Warzel about people becoming desensitized to the COVID-19 death toll. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Is that a concern you have, that the numbers, the daily numbers, just become a background noise here in the United States? What are your thoughts on weighing the impact of the health consequences of COVID-19, the deaths that come from that, versus the need to keep an economy going? How do we balance these things out? Call in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with at-large opinion writer Charlie Warzel with the New York Times. We're talking about people resigning themselves to the amount of sickness and death that comes with reopening the economy amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see this happening? People becoming numb to the daily numbers coming out? What do you think about the trade-offs between shutdowns to help slow the spread of the virus versus the economic damage, the real economic damage that can come along with that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Charlie, as we've mentioned, you are in Montana, not an epicenter. Same here in Wisconsin. We have had hot spots around the state. What do things look like from the vantage of Montana? What are people talking about there?
Yeah, we, very thankfully have been spared the worst, I think, of this outbreak. We are, today we reported zero cases in the state, as we have a couple of different days in the past few weeks. And we, as part of that, have been moving to open up, and we're sort of in almost the second phase of that now, where some restaurants are starting to open up and other places. I think that a lot of the reason for our good fortune has to do with our governor Steve Bullock acting very quickly, shutting down schools after the first case and well before the first death, and with stay-at-home order, very sort of get those cases down. But I think we exist in sort of it's an odd experience to be here, as I'm sure it is in Wisconsin, when you have sort of driven the caseload down, when it does feel like things are under control, there should be a move to open some things back up. Obviously, we can't retreat inside our homes forever. And so it's that balance of trying to figure out how best to do it. And I think there's still a lot of anxiety and concern, given that there's no vaccine, and there's not, there aren't therapeutics that are widely available and effective at the moment. There's still a lot of concern. I think there's so much we don't know about the virus. A popular restaurant in Missoula, the town that I live in, when it was clear that things were going to start opening back up, they pulled their patrons on Facebook and said, who would feel comfortable if we opened up coming back in to eat? And overwhelmingly, the reaction was, we don't feel comfortable. We love you guys, but I don't think we really want to sit down and eat. And so I think there's this very, difficult push and pull right now between wanting to open up the economy, knowing we should, and citizens maybe not being fully on board to participate in the economy.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andrew joins us in Whitewater. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Andrew?
So I just wanted to kind of build off of the point about the restaurant. So I was a server, and I waited on tables, and throughout flu and cold season, we constantly come into contact with, utensils that people are putting in their mouths, napkins that they're wiping their mouths with, sometimes dirty Kleenexes, and really the only thing that you're able to do is, when you do have to handle that sort of stuff, you have to wash your hands after and be aware that, you are handling things that you could come into contact with somebody's, mucus and things like that, and you still go on about your job, and, we don't shut down for flu and cold season. And I just think you have to be aware of what's going on and take precautions like regular hand wash.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. I think that's a common comparison people have made. COVID-19 has been way more dangerous than cold, certainly, and more dangerous than most any flu season on top of the actual flu season. But weighing that that risk that Andrew might have dealt with as a server, Andrew, on the job, that's something a lot of people are doing.
Yeah, I think it's also, it's a really difficult situation to put people in, I think, especially people in the situation of being servers. I mean, this is your livelihood. Everyone should be entitled to a living wage and to be out there working if they want. And yet, there's still so much we're finding out about this virus, about how it affects people, which pre-existing conditions, things like, asthma or smoking or what have you, put you at greater risk. I think we're still trying to figure those very basic things out, and that's difficult for people to hear. And I really understand the idea of letting people take risk, make their own assessments there. But the one thing that I will say is I think if we are moving towards reopening, we do have to have some guidelines that aren't as strict for those people who want to take more risks, and sort of giving people a set of metrics, maybe assigning point values to different risky behaviors, and saying, here's how many points you can tally up before you're really, really putting yourself and others at risk. I think we're going to have to find ways to adapt to this new normal.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Andrew, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Charlie Worzel, at-large opinion writer for The New York Times, looking at the death toll, the impact of COVID-19, and he's concerned, he writes in a recent piece, that we may become numb to the daily figures. Charlie, what I've heard from some public health experts and others is an attempt to change a mindset from, am I personally at risk if I catch this disease? For many young, healthy people, the answer is probably not. And they want to change the framework to, am I at risk of passing this disease on to other people in my life, in my social network, who might be vulnerable to this illness? Can you talk about that mindset idea?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important. I think that, the one way to look at these lockdowns, which I think has been really helpful, is that as the compliance with them has largely been, uniform. And to some degree, they are kind of a profound political act. It is a group of people making a poignant personal sacrifice for others, for the help of, to make sure that the people who you sit next to in church don't get sick, to make sure that your coworkers don't get sick, to the people who you serve at the restaurant or the people who serve you at a restaurant don't get sick. And I think we need to think about it that way, as you said. I also think that, one thing that makes this so difficult is that there is so much asymptomatic spread of this virus, and there is such a little amount of time before the onset of symptoms, and you have to catch it at just the right time, and that in order to do that, we need a very effective system of testing and tracing and contact tracing involved. And part of the reason that people are advocating to keep the lockdowns going in states where there are outbreaks is that system isn't in place yet. I don't think there's anyone who, if we had a national robust testing system and tracing capabilities, anyone who wants this lockdown to continue. It's people wanting this to continue to protect each other and to make sure that, that as many people stay healthy as possible.
Is there, Charlie, you think, an element of the frog in the hot water and all of this? If I told you, I don't know, 8 months ago, hey, next year there's going to be this disaster, it's going to kill 85,000 people in less than 2.5 months, that would have sounded really horrible. But because we've had this steady buildup and this ongoing thing, in the midst of it, it doesn't feel as shocking somehow.
I think so. And I think a lot of this is – You know, we're living through this crisis in real time. There's not a, other than, you know, the 1918 flu, there's not really a precedent for this in most of our lives. So we're living through something that not a lot of people can, you know, have any experiences to draw from. So that makes it really difficult. I do think there is some of that, you know, we become, again, numb to the situation. The first couple of weeks of the lockdown and the virus are terrifying. And, you know, the more we learn about it, the maybe the more we get comfortable with the decisions that we might have to make. But also, it's just simply that we can only be shocked, and we can only be cowering in fear for so long. Our bodies actually, you know, force us to adapt. We're very adaptable beings, and that's a real strength. But in some cases, it can make us act perhaps a little more quickly than we need to. But I think the big issue that I worry about right now is around messaging. That you know, we've told people to stay inside, to flatten the curve, and framed that almost like it was the end game. The flattening the curve has never been the end game. If you listen to epidemiologists and public health officials, flattening the curve is keeping our hospitals from becoming overrun, buying us time to build up testing and tracing, and to discover cures and therapeutics. So we have a new sort of we have a new phase that we have to go into, and that is where we adapt to this and try to get as much normalcy as we can while keeping people safe. And I think there's a lot of people who feel like the goalposts have been moved, that, you know, they thought if they flattened the curve and stayed inside for 2 months, they'd be done. But it turns out we're not. And I understand people who are frustrated with that. And I sympathize greatly with them because this is awful. And it's really, really, it's really difficult. I mean, this is a profoundly tumultuous time in our country's history, and we have to, you know, live through it.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Charlie Worzel, at-large opinion writer for The New York Times. We talked to him today about people, the risk of people becoming desensitized to the rising death toll from COVID-19. Coming up, we'll look at the latest developments in the Michael Flynn case, calls for Attorney General William Barr to resign, transcripts from the Russia investigation, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to two healthcare providers with Wisconsin ties who have been working on the front lines of COVID-19 treatment in New York. It's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, there's been a lot of movement lately in the case of President Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Last week, the Department of Justice says it's seeking to drop charges against Flynn for lying to the FBI about his contacts with the Russian ambassador, which he's twice pleaded guilty to in court. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin applauded the DOJ's move during an interview this week with Wisconsin Eye.
What happened at the tail end of the Obama administration into the transition and the whole setup to a special counsel is outrageous. The corrupt behavior on high-level officials in the FBI is just unprecedented, and those people to date have not been held account. They need to be held accountable. No, I absolutely agree with that. I think Attorney General Barr is a person of real integrity, and I appreciate that he did that.
But a federal judge is putting that request on hold. Yesterday, he appointed a retired judge to present the arguments against the Justice Department's position. Also yesterday, Senator Johnson released a list of names of top Obama officials, including former Vice President Joe Biden, who may have sought to unmask Flynn's identity before Trump was sworn into office. So what does all this mean, and what happens next? Kim Whaley is professor of law at the University of Baltimore, a lawyer, a former U.S. Assistant U.S. attorney, and legal analyst for CBS News. She's author of the book, What You Need to Know About the Right to Vote and Why, which comes out next month. Kim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Nice to be here.
So why is the Justice Department trying to get the charges against Flynn dropped here?
Well, according to the papers, the motion to dismiss the charges, the Justice Department is taking the position not that he didn't lie, but that his lies were not material. That is, they didn't really matter to anything that the law enforcement apparatus was legitimately concerned with, which really leads us right to the Mueller probe and the investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election. We're definitely seeing the Justice Department take the position that that whole endeavor was somehow illegitimate. And that's why, in this instance, Mr. Flynn's conviction should not go forward.
And you mentioned conviction. He pleaded guilty to the crime of lying to the FBI. How unusual is it for a prosecutorial body to then try to withdraw the case?
Yeah, I mean, it is a conviction. There are different ways of being convicted. Of course, the traditional way would be with a jury trial, and there's a verdict. Here, when you plead guilty, the judge has to accept the legitimacy of that and believe you. And in this instance, Judge Sullivan is very concerned because it's quite unusual, as you indicate, not only at this point for the Justice Department to have gone through all these steps and say, you know what, turns out we shouldn't have done it to begin with, but also in this moment, under the special counsel regulations, the entire reason that Robert Mueller did this investigation that produced this particular indictment and guilty plea and not the Justice Department itself was because, in theory, the public was benefiting from an independent investigation, an investigation that wasn't controlled or called ultimately by the president. And here, of course, Mr. Barr has stepped in. He's very close to the president and has destroyed that sense of independence, which goes as far back to, in various iterations, to Watergate itself. The idea being we want prosecutors calling balls and strikes based on facts, not based on their jobs, not based on political affiliations, because the concern is if that's allowed, then people's viewpoint starts getting criminalized. And that's a very different America than we've grown to know.
And now we have nearly 2,000 former Justice Department officials calling on Attorney General Barr to resign. They say he's acting at the behest of President Trump, a charge that Barr has denied. What do you make of these calls for Barr to step down and the accusations that he's, in effect, politicized this case?
Yeah, I mean, this is an extraordinary turn of events. I mean, we've seen this before with prosecutors coming out and former national security officials coming out and former members of the military coming out. All of this is quite unprecedented. And I think we are seeing a shift in the separation of powers under our democracy right now. There's absolutely no question in my mind about it as a constitutional scholar. It didn't start with Mr. Trump, but we're seeing the enlargement of the presidency and very few checks and balances. And if any, really, we have the election in November. So I think what these Justice Department officials are saying is that it protects all Americans to have an institution of the Department of Justice that calls balls and strikes based on facts and not on politics. And Mr. Barr has been very clear even before he took this office, when he really auditioned for the job with a letter back in June, I think 2017 or 2018. He's made it very clear that he views his job as backing this particular man who's sitting in the White House and not necessarily in the interest of all Americans. And I think that does really concern career Justice Department officials. I mean, I was in the Justice Department as well. And most, if not all, government people in government are really there because they care. I mean, they're regular people like you and me. They have families, they have jobs, and they go to work really wanting to do the right thing. And this is very disturbing to many of them.
Talking to Kim Whaley, professor of law at the University of Baltimore, looking at a lot of stories related to former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn over the last week or two. And now we have acting director of National Intelligence Rick Grenell sending Republican senators, including Wisconsin's Ron Johnson, this list of former senior Obama officials who may have tried to have Flynn's identity, the phrase we keep hearing is unmasked, during the transition to the Trump presidency. Can you talk about what we mean when we use this word unmasked in this context?
Well, you know, our national security apparatus does have quite a bit of power, including intercepting conversations that could be in the national interest our law enforcement apparatus knows about. And so unmasking, it sounds sinister, but my understanding is that it essentially means they intercept a conversation and then identify as part of the investigation of the contents of that conversation who was involved in that conversation. That's the notion of unmasking. unmasking. It's quite typical. It's routine. It happens under Trump. It's happened under every president. What's somewhat non-routine is to identify the people that were interested in this kind of information within the government. These are not people that weren't entitled to this kind of information. There's nothing illegal about it. There's, again, nothing sinister, nothing violative of the law or even of the interests of the public. But the way it's coming out right now with this DNI Director of National Intelligence, I think creates a perception that's understandable that somehow there's wrongdoing here. But we as Americans need to know what's happening in our national security system in order to stay safe.
And the origins of this were, as I understand it, the intelligence community had been monitoring the communications of this particular Russian ambassador. In the reports, they said that that ambassador had been in contact with individuals. And then the unmasking is people in the Obama administration saying, yeah, who's this individual that the Russian ambassador has been talking to? Do I have that to write in a nutshell?
Right. And that is, of course, Michael Flynn, who ended up pleading guilty to lying to the Federal Bureau of Investigation about those conversations, in part about his discussions with the Russian ambassador about lifting sanctions against Russia once Mr. Obama took office. So back again to the case and the Justice Department's motion to dismiss Mr. Flynn, the position is that this is not material. And I would say certainly it is material. It's material to the investigation, to which we know now from bipartisan Senate intelligence committees, as well as from the Mueller report, that the Russians did interfere in 2016, and they continue to interfere in 2016. And that's an assault on our democracy. It's not a political thing. So materiality, I mean, let me give you another example. If you think of sort of a car crash, whether the light was red or green is material. I mean, if it were red, then that would be a violation of basic rules of safety. If the car is red or green, that's not material. So essentially what the Justice Department is saying is, you know, whether Mr. Flynn lied about his conversations with the Russian ambassador is not material to anything that's in the interest of national intelligence. But of course, why would he lie if that's not important? And I think that's really the question.
We're talking about the ongoing Michael Flynn case and other developments related to the Russia investigation. Kim Whaley is with us, law professor at the University of Baltimore, lawyer and former U.S. Assistant attorney. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a take on the most recent events related to Michael Flynn and the Obama administration in the closing days before the Trump administration came in? Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how all this stuff works? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about Michael Flynn and the Russia probe with Kim Whaley, law professor at the University of Baltimore, a lawyer, former assistant U.S. attorney, and legal analyst for CBS News, author of the forthcoming book, What You Need to Know About the Right to Vote and Why. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you have to say about the latest moves in the Flynn case? Should the Justice Department have tried to drop these charges? Should a judge allow that to happen? How about requests from former Obama administration officials that ultimately revealed the identity of Michael Flynn as the person talking to the Russian ambassador? Should Attorney General Barr resign over his handling of the case? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kim, one concern that people have raised is, okay, maybe these Obama administration officials deserved access to Michael Flynn's name, but somebody, it appears, leaked it to the Washington Post. And that's something that doesn't seem to be quite all right, is it?
In general, are not good for a functioning government, and Obama was quite harsh, actually, on leakers, and I think that I agree that is of concern. People leak all the time, but when they're leaking national security information, that can endanger the United States, and that's quite serious.
I want to give a listen to former vice president and now presidential candidate Joe Biden. He was asked on Tuesday, before that list came out, asked on ABC News Good Morning America whether he was involved in an anti-Trump plan to frame Flynn. Here's a little what he had to say.
I know nothing about those moves to investigate Michael Flynn, number one. Number two, this is all about diversion. This is a game this guy plays all the time. The country is in crisis. We're in an economic crisis, a health crisis. We're in real trouble. He should stop trying to always divert attention from the real concerns of the American people.
So what's your take on what Biden had to say there?
You know, I have to agree with him because, again, the Russians did interfere in the 2016 election, and that was a legitimate investigation and one that goes to the heart of our democracy. If we don't have free and fair elections where we go to the booth and we choose our own elected officials, if those are distorted, that's really problematic across the political spectrum. And what Mr. Biden is saying, I mean, Mr. Flynn committed a crime. He admitted to committing a crime in connection with that. That's really the smoking gun, not whether, you know, it wasn't sort of optimal in how they got to that point. I think if people commit crimes, that's a good thing that they are held accountable, even if there are missteps going forward to get to that point. I think that's his point. And of course, I also agree with the COVID crisis, as I'm sure many of your listeners would agree, that that's really front and center right now, in addition to the November 2020 election, which is going to in part be affected by this pandemic.
Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, this whole thing is in response to the Mueller report, which was a report prepared for the Justice Department, not for public information. Attorney General Barr released the report, made it public so that we could see what was in the report. And there is no evidence of Russian collusion. That's been established. They tried to impeach Trump over this. They failed. There is no Russian. The only influence Russia had was on social media. And people voted, and they voted for Hillary, yes, in popular vote, but Trump won 31 states and won the electoral vote. It was a legitimate election, and this was Comey and others trying to undermine the legitimate election of a president.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Kim, what do you think?
Well, there's a huge distinction between the word collusion and the word conspiracy. And this is something, frankly, Mr. Barr unfortunately blurred for the American public. Collusion is just a regular everyday word. And I think some people would say the Mueller report does show that the Trump campaign knew about the Russians' assistance. And there's all kinds of facts relating to that. And there are communications. What Mueller concluded was there wasn't a meeting of the minds to sway the election. That's conspiracy. That's a legal concept. Very, very hard to prove. You have to essentially find proof that crawls into someone's subjective state of mind. And that's what he did not find evidence of. He expressly said, I did not make a conclusion on the word collusion because it's not a legal concept. And, you know, those contacts with the Russians, I think, are deeply, deeply concerning for every single American. I don't think a Democrat in office should be communicating about an election with a foreign power that our last Republican president, President Bush, included in an axis of evil. Mr. Putin is not a friend of America, not a friend of Democrats, and not a friend of Republicans.
In our last couple of minutes, Kim, I want to look ahead at this election here. Do you think with all the political back and forth that there's been enough effort to prevent future acts of interference?
No, I mean, there's been many bills before Congress to address this since 2016, most of which have been, or many of which I should say, have been stalled by Mitch McConnell. And we are not only going into an election where they're probably, or at least the intelligence officials say, including Mr. Mueller, that there is attempts. The caller's not so concerned about social media, but that's a new phenomenon in the digital age, and it's having an impact on lots of aspects of American life, including voting. But secondly, of course, the virus itself is going to disenfranchise a lot of people from being able to actually cast their votes because it's going to be dangerous to go to the polls. There are not going to be as many polls open, and there isn't the funding or legal authority in all 50 states and jurisdictions to vote by mail or to vote early. So, you know, again, the framers of the Constitution, the revolutionaries, they fought and they died to not have a monarchy. They fought and they died to choose their own government. And that is a core American value that cuts across political spectrum. It's not a Democratic value. It's a Republican, Democrat, Independent, whoever. The ability to choose for ourselves and not have Mr. Putin and whoever else influence that, I think, is absolutely vital. And I, you know, as a mother, I think it's something I want to cherish and promote for the next generation.
Kim, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking to Kim Whaley, professor of law at the University of Baltimore, a lawyer, a former assistant U.S. attorney, and a legal analyst for CBS News. We've been talking about cases related to Michael Flynn, information released to Congress, the Department of Justice asking to withdraw the Michael Flynn case in the first place. She's also, by the way, the author of What You Need to Know About the Right to Vote and Why, set to come out next month, and we might bring her back to talk about that book. As of today, more than 430 Wisconsinites have died of COVID-19, according to the state's Department of Health Services. Their loved ones are grappling with not being able to visit them during their final days or gather for a traditional funeral. As Bridget Bowden reports, it's changing the way people grieve.
Renee Sarton Kirby of Racine will remember her brother Anthony as an outgoing, fun-loving person.
He had a memory for detail. You know, could remember all the sports stats going back to Bart Starr playing with the Packers.
Anthony Sarton died of COVID-19 in Milwaukee at the age of 64 on April 29th. He had been living in an assisted living facility in Bayside for about 5 years and was sent to the emergency room earlier that month when his caregivers thought he might be having a mild stroke. After some tests, he was diagnosed with COVID. He remained in the hospital for several more weeks.
He was doing well for a while, and I could still call and have the nurse put the phone to his ear, and he would squeeze her hand and open his eyes and was responding, but then he stopped responding.
Sarton Kirby considers herself the caregiver in her family. In the past, she would go with Anthony whenever he needed procedures. So not being able to visit him during his last days was extremely hard.
It weighed on me. How was he doing? You know, what was he thinking?
Even having a funeral is difficult right now, she says. Under the governor's safer at home order, funerals are allowed, but limited to 10 people or fewer. Her family planned a small visitation with members paying their respects in shifts.
It really changes, I think, the dynamics of how people grieve and how you get closure from death, being able to connect with family and hug them. You know, we'll be in masks. I'll be able to bring my mother there, but she'll have to self-quarantine when she gets back in her room.
Kiri Meyer is the bereavement coordinator at Horizon Home Care and Hospice Grief Resource Center in the Milwaukee area. She says families are getting creative with FaceTiming loved ones in the hospital and live streaming funeral services.
But I think we can all agree that it's not the same. It's not the same as being able to hold that person's hand or, you know, put your hand on their head or really kind of have that in-person connection.
Meyer and other grief professionals are concerned that there will be a stigma associated with the virus, and people will be afraid to support their grieving friends and neighbors. She suggests shifting the focus to people's full lives rather than just how they died.
And really try to remind people about the person, not the illness, because the illness is only a tiny little bit of that person's story.
For Sarton Kirby, though, it was important for people to know what happened to her brother, especially because he was African-American. While African-Americans make up less than 7% of Wisconsin's population, they represent 29% of people who have died of COVID-19. Governor Evers called coronavirus-related deaths in Milwaukee's Black community a crisis within a crisis. When Sarton Kirby wrote her brother's obituary, she put his COVID diagnosis in the first sentence.
Especially because I believe there are some who don't take it seriously, that we are in the midst of a pandemic, a public health crisis. And I believe that all of our lives will be touched.
She says she's coping with the way the disease has touched her life by leaning on her faith. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can get the latest coverage of COVID-19 in Wisconsin online at WPR.org/coronavirus. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get the latest reactions to the end of Wisconsin's safer at home order, and you can join in with your thoughts. President Trump isn't the first chief executive to deal with a major pandemic. The author of the book Presidents, Pandemics, and Politics joins the show with lessons from the past. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Whether you want to cut back on meat a little, you want to go full veg, or you just want to try something new, our guest is going to offer us lots of satisfying recipes for vegetarian meals. As always, you can find some of those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, it's the weekly call-in for kids and parents with a focus on drawing, artwork, and creativity. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to Milk Street's Chris Kimball about living the simple life in our kitchens and beyond. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.